This is Dylan FM, the podcast that goes deep into the work and world of Bob Dylan. If you love Dylan, you're in the right place with your host, Craig Danieloff.
Let's continue our focus on Dylan's five worst years, 1984 to 1988, with a focus talk on the idea that Bob Dylan was struggling during those times. Yes, it's relative, and no, it wasn't all bad, but something was happening. So today we look at what that was and how fans and the press have reacted to and talked about Bob Dylan's work and life in the mid-80s. My guest is Aaron Callahan, who regularly hosts the Dylantons podcast and is the co-author and co-editor of a recently released book called The Politics and Power of Bob Dylan's Live Performances, which looks at Dylan through the lens of his set lists. I talked with Aaron and her co-author Court Carney on a recent episode, and together they'll be editing an upcoming book on Dylan in the 80s. They also co-hosted a panel at the World of Bob Dylan conference in Tulsa last year on Dylan in the 80s that was fun and engaging and very popular. And beyond all that Dylan cred, Aaron is a professor of English at the San Jacinto College in Houston, Texas. Our discussion today lasts about an hour and covers a lot of Dylan ground. You're listening to the public feed, which includes about a third of that discussion. To hear the rest, along with the extended versions and bonus episodes of our 50-plus Dylan FM shows, plus all of Aaron's great interviews on the Dylantons, Rob Kelly's Pod Dylan, Ray Padgett's new show on Dylan cover songs, and more, much more, become a FM Plus subscriber. You can do that right in Apple Podcasts or at fmpods.com. And not only will your $5 a month help all these great podcasts keep going, but you won't ever have to listen to appeals like this again. So now, let's hear our chat about Bob Dylan struggling his way through the mid-80s. All right, welcome, Aaron Callahan. Thanks for volunteering for the task no one wants, talking about Bob Dylan in the 80s.
Well, thanks for having me. And I am absolutely thrilled to talk about Bob Dylan in the 80s, as you know, from my panel. And I thought about my own listening appetites and that I tend to, as you say, we just skip the 80s by and large, except for those few highlights that we like. You know, and then also, I thought about the narratives that are created and the discussion forums or groups that I'm in, probably with the exception of Laura Tenchert's, that they linger in the 60s, mostly pre-motorcycle accident, because that seems to be, in Cohen's theory, the monster that won't die for Dylan, that identity that he has. And then we move on to Blood on the Tracks, skip to Rolling Thunder, quick stop in the gospel era, and we jump right to Time Out of Mind. And that's sort of what you said. And so you said we skip over it as sort of a wasteland, and I think in a bad way, not in a T.S. Eliot kind of way, because that's Desolation Row. And so the few times we have stopped in those other groups, people really hate the 80s. And I was in one where we talked about I, and I think it's a great song. And of course, that's out of the framework that we're talking about today, but I is lovely. And people in that group just were angry that we had to listen to it and talk about it.
That's the thing I want to unpack kind of in this series a little bit. You know, I think the simplest way is to look at it on its own, because it's obvious that if you put it next to the 60s or part of the 70s or, you know, what happened in the late 90s and on, the problem is kind of the dynamic range. In other words, those other things are so high that this gets squashed into this little zone.
Right.
And then you think of it as this narrow zone, and that's fine until you go back. And I've, you know, there's a opening episode of this where I'm kind of telling the story of this time frame, but it, as we know, once you look at it, there's just incredible things there. And the funny thing is that those same people who will dismiss the 80s, you know, love Brownsville Girl, or they love the Tom Petty stuff, or they're, you know, Wilburys fans, or all these things out of the period they think they don't like are there. To me, it's simply a matter of looking at it on its own. And, you know, it's like a graph, you know, from far away, there's not a lot of movement here. You zoom in and all of a sudden, hey, there's a lot of stuff, both a lot of things that make up the line and a lot of, you know, peaks and valleys. There's a pile of songs, you know, that are great. As you proved in Tulsa, there's also a passion. Maybe it's a reflex or people rebelling now against the negative sentiment. I think that that covers album that came out, you know, kind of played on it and made it cool again.
But I think that that's part of, you know, the wonderful thing about Dylan's studies is that we have people inside and outside of the academy. And as an academic, I was thinking, why do so few people puzzle through this most challenging decade in his career? There's got to be something. And you just proved that to be true. But so it piqued my interest looking at the 80s from the viewpoint of 2022 or 2023, where we can work through how that decade and the work he produces and it fits within his entire canon. And so to do that, you have to examine the existing framework. And so the underlying question for me was, what are the narratives that exist around Dylan in the 1980s and how have they shaped how we approach them? And I think what you just said really speaks to that, because we do have these narratives that are the foundation of, or the framework of how we understand Dylan. Because if you're an obsessive, and again, that's a term you use, which I think is appropriate, whether you are a fan, and they're really, I don't think there are many casual Dylan fans. I think you jump right in, or an academic, like whatever, wherever you are on the spectrum, you started out by listening and then something touched you and then you started reading, and the whatever you read, whether it was Rolling Stone or Grail Marcus or any of those folks, Michael Gray, Robert Shelton. I mean, I'm looking at my bookcase and I can just go through the list. They helped create that authoritative voice of how we look at Dylan in the 80s, Paul Williams. And there's not a lot of positive literature or narratives about what goes on in the 80s. And so that has shaped how it had shaped how I looked at Dylan in the 80s. And that also created expectations. And I don't want to seem like I'm being glib. We owe that first generation of Dylan fans, scholars, and critics a debt of gratitude, because they created this conversation that we have, this playground that we all get to, you know, experience now. And they also have the privilege of living through Dylan in real time. And so I think that through his creative process and growth, and there's a lot that, you know, going from 61 to 66, so much change, and it's all great. That I think when you get to, you know, you go through the 70s and you have Blood on the Tracks and Rolling Thunder and even the gospel era, there's some good stuff. But you get to the 80s and you feel that there's this incredible letdown. And so they were reacting to their own expectations. And so it would make sense that they look at Dylan as his creative output waning a little bit. Don't you think?
Yeah, one of the things, as Michael Gray and I've talked through the Song and Dance Man book, has come up a lot, is the difference between the contemporaneous reactions and the retrospective one.
Right.
You know, he told me last week, we were talking about, you know, how Blood on the Tracks was not universally, you know, lauded when it came out. There's that. And then there's the fact that, yeah, if you go through the 60s and the 70s and Rolling Thunder and, you know, whatever you thought about Born Again period, and now you're standing in the middle of, you know, Knocked Out Loaded, or you can go, oh, my reaction today is this is not good. But we now, you know, get to look at it in a different way. And then there's the fact, maybe for Dylan more than anyone, that it takes 5 or 10 or 20 or 30 years to catch up to him, or to, you know, see it in its own light. So yeah, anyway, it's all about reevaluation. You know, the fact that you've looked at it in the big picture and thought about it, you know, and taking somewhat of an academic view on it, and particularly your theory about the arc of his career. And so why don't I let you introduce it, and just let's just go in on how it does sit in the arc and what it means for a guy like Dylan to suddenly be 45 years old, you know, and Prince being at the top of the charts, and having lived through the 30 years, 25 years he lived through before that. All that plays in.
I think there are a few ways. And one of the things that I said to you, and it was actually someone in our 80s panel said it, and it was an articulation of what I was thinking, and I just didn't say it as eloquently. She said that we have to let our geniuses struggle and fail. And I don't think that we've allowed Dylan to do that. And so when we look at this period, it's just seen as a blank failure, because we're not watching him work through whatever he's trying to work through in terms of his own creative process as an artist. And so there are a few ways that I've puzzled through that. And then we can talk about, you know, I can tell you the different ways that I'm considering this as, you know, we're putting the one book to bed and working on the next one, starting to gear up towards it, is that I think that first, he is creating out of contractual obligation. And so now we're looking at this in a very academic way. His art is less a creation. It's always been a product in an industrial capitalist society. But there were, in previous years, he was so focused on the creation process that he wasn't just looking at the, or solely looking at the contractual obligation of it. And so now it's work for him. This is real work. And so, and he says that he's quoted a few times as saying that, and a lot of this is frustration, where he says that it's like working in a coal mine. And so, you know, he's definitely feeling this idea of hard labor. He is looking at it in terms of you just don't, the recording technology has changed. And so he gripes that it used to be that you just turned on the microphone and you recorded, and what you heard in the room with you is what they captured, you know, at the soundboard. And so he's frustrated with that. So those are two things: that he's frustrated with the fact that it's work that he's doing, like he's forced to be working. He says, "You're a man is free if he gets up every day and does what he wants to do." We can tell he doesn't necessarily want to be doing this just by his raspy voice. They're uninspired. And so there, that's interesting to me. But another argument that you can make is that when he has those moments, he's able to go back to roots music. And when he's uninspired, whether it's going back to, you know, playing with the band in Woodstock, when he is burned out from the 66 tour after the motorcycle accident, and that seems to reinvigorate him. And then also the gospel period tends to reinvigorate him as well. And so he goes back to this roots music. And when he has his epiphany later on, it's with jazz. And so there's another moment in his career where he feels a connection to music that he feels is sacred, which then goes back to his childhood, listening to those radio stations late at night, that he felt a connection to that music that was almost sacred to him. And so he can't seem to find that in 85, 86, when he's, you know, to quote Grail early on from 1970, like, what is this shit? Like, that's how we feel about it in the 85. So those are his frustrations, that the recording process is different. It feels like work to him. He's only doing it for the sake of work. And he can't kind of use roots music at this point as a way to renew his connection to what he's doing. So I think that's kind of how it fits, because we see those frustrations, but then there's a lot of good stuff there, I think. I say my question is, like, what is good in my notes? Obviously every grain of sand is before, but blind, these are the objectively good things, right? Blind Willie McTell, Series of Dreams, Brownsville Girl, Dark Eyes, the tours, and maybe more so specific shows within the tours. When we were in Tulsa, I was talking to Anne-Marie Mai, and she said that the Santana tour she saw in Copenhagen, and he was awful. He was cranky and grumpy, and he wasn't responding to the crowd. And you know that you've been in shows where he seems grumpier. Even the shows I saw last weekend, the last one, he seemed much grumpier the last night than he did the two nights before. And he just sort of did his thing, and he really didn't talk to us. But the night before he joked, he made a joke about Tony. So I think that's part of it. But he just, so I think it's more individual performances in that era. And I think when we say, oh, this era is awful, it's not. That's a narrative that we have to break down, because he's got the Heartbreakers tours, like you said, and the Letterman show that people tend to respond to as genius. And so I think people are being overly critical of him based on their expectations. And based on, like you're saying, that high caliber of work that he did. And so he admits in the 1980s, and I think more famously than the 60 Minutes episode with Ed Bradley in 2004, that writing that he did previously was magic and he couldn't do it anymore.
I think it's actually an interesting point about return to roots, which obviously he's done many times. Mm-hmm. What we know about the practice sessions for Letterman appearance with the plug was right. that they you know, he was jamming with those guys for months, as Ray Padgett right. just illustrated. And there's a little less of that in the mid 80s, or at least it we don't know as much about him driving to that well at that time. You know, this idea about him being contractually obligated, to be honest, I kind of feel like, you know, Bob, like anybody else, and maybe more, does some revisionist history and finds an excuse after the fact when he needs it. Mm-hmm. I always have a hard time when people say that. I mean, it's come up many times in his career, and he says it. Imagine Bob actually saying, I'm going to go do this now because they want me to. It just seems so counter to his, you know, if he wanted to take 3 years off, I kind of feel like he would take 3 years off, even though there probably was a contract.
Right.
And I also feel like these albums, you know, he's trying, he might know, it seems evident he knows he's not in the same place.
Right.
But you know, as you said, there's a struggle. He is struggling. He's not succeeding. Right. The other thing we learn as we get access to the tapes and, you know, obviously a little bit of this, we started to get bootleg theories. You know, there's two or three of these albums that were built over multiple years.
Right.
It's really just going in, recording songs, going in, recording songs. And ultimately, there kind of was enough to cobble together. You know, I mean, Knocked Out Loaded, I think, is that way. And Down in the Groove is a mm-hmm. little bit that way.
Right.
But again, my guess completely is that he was going in the studio because he wanted to go figure it out. He wanted right. to do it, even if he knew he was, you know, it wasn't one cohesive project and didn't know already in his head where he wanted to be at the end, where he might have been many before and many after.
No, there isn't. We can argue there isn't a cohesive project. Yes, I think he wants to be in the studio, but I also think that, and there's contemporaneous journalism that says he's, you know, it's for the money. There's a speculation there that he's just doing it because he has to. But there, one thing that would support your argument is, I think, on Knocked Out Loaded, when he has all of those musicians come in and he's playing with, you know, Jerry Garcia, he's all those folks coming in and he's composing with Robert Hunter, like, and even Down in the Groove, it's Down in the Groove he does that, isn't it? Just misspoke. But he, and then he's playing with, he's writing with Sam Shepard, and he's trying to work with other people to compose. And my argument for that, or my maybe, and I could be wrong, and I accept anything that I say about Dylan could be wrong, but he may be trying to create those connections that he felt when he was returning to roots music, when he was playing with the band in Woodstock, that he's trying to find that sort of homosocial connection where he's in a group of men, and there are female backup singers, but they are secondary. But he's working with a group of people that he feels, you know, some sort of companionship or camaraderie with, but it still doesn't quite work for him. As we see, where it does work is in the impromptu creation of the Wilburys. And we know the story of how that just sort of happens one night. And so that to me seems more organic. And then that's something that tends to work for him because it doesn't feel forced.
That's a set of great examples of him, you know, in their slugging, you know,
right.
calling people, bringing things in, trying to find it. I mean, there's no doubt that, you know, to me, his age, right, as we've said before, right, nobody or very few people had been a 43-year-old, 44-year-old guy in that position.
Right.
The world was very different. There's Elvis calls it, Costello calls it the decade music forgot, the 80s. Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, there's a lot of people who were in a funk then, maybe because they were all hitting a different age and, you know, mm-hmm. they're all interacting with all the changes, right? The outside of their era. They used to be the center of social world. They're all of a sudden not of the age to be the center.
Right.
So that requires a shift of focus and head. They all mm-hmm. had come up with, you know, work that was compelling and interesting and aren't the kind of people who want to do it for the 26th year.
Right.
So, you know, a second act, a third act, a fourth act is very hard to find. The
Dylan
idea
says
that the period of struggle is, I think that's really interesting, and it does sum it up in a way it hasn't been before. And I mean, there's two things. One is, you know, for those of us who care about Dylan or enjoy Dylan, you know, reading the phone book or watching him struggle is perfectly acceptable thing to do.
Right.
And then I also think secondarily that if you look at the challenge Dylan always has is being compared to Dylan.
Right.
So he's said that and others have. And as I listen to this set of albums, you know, two things are true. One, they're not 60s or 90s Dylan necessarily, with some songs. I mean, you gave a list. I put Tight Connection in there.
Right.
You know, maybe Someday. Silvio, which, you know, is obviously somewhat of a cover, a co-write. Or it's a cover, really. You know, I was listening to Empire Burlesque this morning. And, you know, there's some mm-hmm. fantastic stuff on there. There's certainly a tinge of 80s production, but that's mm-hmm. fine. It was the 80s.
Right.
And there's some stuff that's less compelling, but it's two things. It's Bob Dylan doing something less compelling, and it never right. feels un-Dylan-like. And there's a word, a phrase here or there. There's the way he uses his voice and these other things right. that we like about him that in the large perspective tend to not get mentioned. And also, I just think on its own, you put him next to, you know, there's the whole world of their additional Bob Dylans or near Bob Dylans kind of guys who, you know, we all like and listen to, but no, never hit the Dylan level. And
right.
I kind of felt like trying to think about this, that to some degree, a bunch of these songs in this period are more like those guys' songs. They're not bad songs. They still have that Dylan component in them, but it's just him not, you know, scoring a 10 out of 10 for a while and banging out some sixes and fours and sevens.
But I think the point that people think that's unacceptable for him is part of the problem.
Totally.
You know, that's maybe the underlying question is like why we're seeing him, you know, puzzle through his own creativity, trying to work within the framework using a synthesizer. One of the major complaints, other than the ones about his voice, is about the overproduction. Another is about the simplicity of the lyrics. And so, you know, we have to wrestle with those now as he's wrestling with them. And I think that, you know, that's a good place. But what you were saying about people not knowing their place, and that was something I said in the 80s, that he's in an unprecedented space where there haven't been elder rock and rollers. And, you know, is he trying to stay relevant, or how does he stay relevant? And he said in 84 to Kurt Loder, it's either your time or it's not your time. And I don't feel like the last few years is really my time. Then 85, he says, I've made all the difference I'm going to. My place is secure, whatever it is. And then he's like, he's not going to worry about doing the next thing or keeping it in step with the times, but he's clearly trying to. But then he says, like, I'm not trying to prove that I'm the top dog. But then he also says, and I think this is probably one of my favorite quotes, it's from Rolling Stone Australia, you're always guided to where you are. And this sounds to me the most Dylan-esque kind of, you know, a little bit obtuse or abstract, but he says, you're always guided to where you are, but you have a choice to mess it up. And maybe that's what he's doing here. He's kind of messing it up, and we have to allow him to mess it up. Sooner or later, everything that goes around comes around. So yeah, I feel like I've been guided to wherever I am right now, but I don't know whatever it is I'm supposed to be doing. I might have to do something else. So he's
great.
You know, he's telling us in real time, like, I'm trying to figure it out. And I feel like people are, because of the expectations that we have for him, because of the narratives created, that they're not as generous to him as they might be if they understood that he's a creative person trying, you know, outside of being a pop culture icon. He's really an artist trying to struggle through a dip in his own creativity and trying to figure out how to work through. So I love those quotes, because that last one especially is telling us about.
To hear the rest of this conversation and get access to over 100 other subscriber-only Dylan podcasts and a few on Steely Dan too, see the show notes to see how you can sign up for FM Plus for just $4.99 a month. We would really appreciate your support.
Did you enjoy this show? Then please rate this podcast and leave a review. It really helps. Also, sign up for 7 Days, our free weekly newsletter that puts all the top Bob Dylan news and links into your inbox every Sunday. Use the link in the show notes. Thanks for listening.